Hello, pals of mine. Just finished a book you short attention span readers might enjoy. Me, Myself, and Why by Mary Janice Davidson. It centers around a secret or behind-the-scenes organization of the FBI, which employs individuals with special challenges. Sociopaths, kleptomaniacs, etc. The lead character has a multiple personality disorder. The reason I say it's a great book for short attention spans is because as the lead character switches personalities, the chapter ends for the switch off. So many chapters are only 2 pages long. It's definitely an unusual premise. Again, that's Me, Myself, and Why by Mary Janice Davidson. As you know, I frequently visit the coast, specifically Mendocino County, where my parents grew up and my dad's family still owns a home. There's a Facebook page called You Know You're From Mendocino County If, where people often post vintage photos. Last week, a photo from the 1920s was posted. It has a picture of a handful of clearly drunk men, a few with a bottle in their hands, and it's presumably during Prohibition because handwritten in white ink is written, Our Friend the Blind Pig. For those who aren't aware, during Prohibition, flasks were often manufactured from pig bladders, hence the slang, blind pig, which segued into a common nickname for speakeasies. Whiskey, of course, has a much longer history than Prohibition. Wesley and Katie Scoville created an informative and educational website, The Life of a Whiskey Drinker, to share their love of whiskey. I sat down with Wesley and we talked all things Red Eye.
Driving over here, Willie Nelson popped up in my mind. So I have Whiskey River is stuck in my brain now. Whiskey River, don't run dry.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I started thinking of other songs like, you know, White Lightning. And then, of course, all those blues songs that were dripping with whiskey of every type, homemade and otherwise. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was a movie just recently come out, Lawless, the Tom Hardy, and that White Lightning was, it was about Prohibition, and White Lightning was all throughout the movie. All about moonshine and whiskey all throughout the Prohibition days. It's very good.
My older cousin talked about his dad, who had his own still during Prohibition, and his strongest memory was the drunk cat, because it would be lapping up the spillage.
Wow, that
he was like 9 years old. He just remembers his cat trying to walk across the property.
That's great.
Well, in the news recently, speaking of necessary crafting of whiskey, but a lot of people were disappointed when they found out that a lot of these craft whiskeys actually came from one spot.
Yeah, MGPI, which previously was LDI, and then previously was Seagram's Distillery for a good number of years. And that's kind of the big thing right now with craft distilleries. You know, in the early 90s, you kind of had a few guys start out. You had, you know, Anchor Brewing, they started a distillery. You had some guys in Alameda started a distillery, a few, but nothing really caught on until around 2008 or so. And up until this point, most people, when you think craft distillery, you think very small distilleries producing their own distillate. And from what we've been finding is really craft distillery generally means two things. It means you're either producing, bottling, packaging, selling, or you're buying from a much larger distillery and rebranding it as your own.
Distributing it.
Yeah, essentially. You're a distributor. And in general, that's not uncommon. I mean, Scotland, I mean, it's all blended whiskey is blended Scotch whiskey is, you know, essentially rebranding, kind of repackaging. You get a lot of distilleries producing whiskey and rebranding under a different name, depending on who owns what. But what was happening here was a lot of these guys were kind of creating their own legends and stories. And then all of a sudden, you know, it's Templeton, for example, is a great example of LDI's first product. So when Seagram's was going to close down, they were going to mothball the distillery in around 2008. So perfect time. All these craft distilleries were just about to explode in the U.S. And Seagram's was just going to be closing. Angostura buys up this Seagram's distillery and renames it LDI. And from there, their first, they decide, because they have all this whiskey, basically, you know, see, they buy Seagram's, this distillery with all the whiskey, and they need to do something with it. And so they begin selling it to other people. And Templeton Rye is their first person they sell it to, with a 95% rye mash bill, essentially meaning rye grain is 95% of that mash bill, and then it's probably corn or malted barley for the next 5%. And that was a mash bill that was used for Seagram's, and it would be then blended with a grain alcohol for their own whiskey. But now they were just selling the stuff as 95% rye. And so Templeton was that first one, and they, Templeton, Iowa, and they were simply, they came up with this whole story, you know, it was Al Capone's favorite whiskey, the good stuff, and they were just going with that story. They no talk about where it was coming from. They kind of built this facility, they're packaging it, bottling it, and sending it off. And a lot of these distilleries started popping up amidst a lot of guys who had their own stills, producing very small batch craft whiskey, doing it their own way, along these guys who just were buying product and distributing it, essentially. And so it made things very confusing. And that was kind of all around 2008 when it just started exploding. I remember my wife and I were in Portland, Oregon. We lived in Portland, Oregon for about 5 years, and there was a distillery there. I was really excited. I had just heard about it. I bought a bottle and I tasted it, and I was a little underwhelmed, to say the least. And I found out that they were buying unaged spirit and aging it themselves. So I'll say that first, I mean, LDI makes a very good product in general because they've been doing it for a very long time. But these guys were aging it themselves. They didn't know a whole lot about aging unaged whiskey, and it wasn't coming out very well. They ended up rebranding themselves again a couple years later, as I looked back. And, you know, I was angry. A lot of people were angry because it was kind of, you felt a little deceived, you know? And so that was disheartening. And I think with a lot of, you know, the big problem has been a lot of people have taken the, you know, the craft brewing industry, and they've said, oh yeah, craft brewing, it's very much like craft distilling. It's the same thing. The progression has been the same exact thing, where it's craft brewing was a reaction from these huge large companies, you know, creating really poor products, and we want to create good products. And craft distilling is not necessarily that way. And what you see, and because that's what I was saying with LDI, they create really good products. And so it wasn't necessarily that them being a big giant company was a bad thing. It was that a lot of people just were being a little deceptive in terms of what was going on.
And craft, just that word in and of itself, has connotations.
Oh yeah. I mean, we don't even now, I mean, it's hard to even understand what craft really means. I mean, when you think of craft, usually you think of, and as someone who's takes science and art and blends those two things together. I mean, that's how I think of it. But it's also become such a popular thing to use today, and so everyone's, you know, doing, even the, you know, the big breweries, the big distilleries, you see craft over all their labeling. And so it's very confusing, I think, in where we're at right now, because, you know, what is craft? What is artisan?
Well, artisan is what people were assuming erroneously, mm-hmm. that they were purchasing.
Yeah.
And there's a demographic, understandably, were pissed.
Yeah.
If they think that they're buying aged whiskey.
Yeah.
Seriously aged quality whiskey, and find out, no, I'm sorry, that's from a little podunk town who's just trying to make a name for themselves,
yeah.
and there's no history there at all. And
yeah. I think the thing is there has been a lot of, there are those guys, and then there are a lot of really legit people. I mean,
yeah. So let's talk about some of those.
So yeah, take High West. They use MGPI, which LDI sold again a couple years later, and MGPI is MGP ingredients, is what they're called now. Funny thing is, until I was reading Whiskey Advocate, I think it was just a couple months ago or just recently last year, they had a whole article on MGPI, which before they switched over, when it was LDI, you couldn't even get an interview with these people. They were so hands-off, you couldn't even talk to them. And now they're a little more upfront, but I think because of so much of the reaction that's happened. But anyways, going back to High West, they're one of their clients, and they've probably been one of the most open people about it. And that's why a lot of people haven't necessarily been as angry at them. So they started in Park City, Utah, and they were going to start as...
Now that's called irony.
Yeah.
Of all the states.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. And they started a distillery, and they were working with one of the distillers from Four Roses. And he had suggested, because it's one thing, one of the reasons this is happening is craft distilling is incredibly difficult to start. To start a craft distillery is incredibly difficult. I mean, you think about most of the laws are pre-prohibition laws that are, or just prohibition laws, right after prohibition ended. A lot of the laws haven't changed. It's a lot of, you have to put a lot of money into it. Your distillery has to be pretty much fully set up before they're going to even grant you the license to distill. So you have to put in a lot of money before you even have a product. And home distilling is completely illegal in every single state. So how are these craft distillers actually learning how to distill? It's difficult. And so what a lot of these guys thought was, well, I'll buy whiskey from some other large distillery, sell that while I'm trying to get my start. And so that was really the reason why behind a lot of these guys doing it. It wasn't trying to trick people necessarily. It was trying to just get income. And what happened was they just never started. They never produced their own whiskey. They just kept selling this product. High West kind of does both. They produce their own product, and then they produce kind of a range of different whiskeys. And Campfire is one of those, which is a blend of rye whiskey, bourbon, and peated whiskey. Some of the products for this particular whiskey is blended with GPI. They do a wonderful job. They're like really, I really think blending is such an art in itself that people don't, you know, understand. I think right now, culturally, like, I think because people are so into kind of having the base foundation, like single malts or like it, I don't want to talk about blended whiskey.
Purists?
Yeah, the purist. This kind of thing is, for a lot of people, is not their thing, but they produce a really good product. And they were kind of upfront with it very early on. And there's been a few other guys, like Bullet Bourbon. If you've heard of Bullet Bourbon, they're another LDI product too. Which is kind of interesting. A lot of these huge, I mean, there's a lot of big guys out there too. Then you have a lot of guys up in Portland or even St. George in Alameda. They're doing everything on their own. They're not sourcing. I think actually, now that I think of it, St. George does source. A lot of the small guys do, just because it's very difficult. I mean, you think starting a company where your product has to be, you know, around 4 years old by the time you sell it. It's how do you do that? How do you start a company when people want an aged product right out of the door?
A little Benjamin Button.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why we saw a lot of white whiskey or white lightning, whatever you want to call it,
clearer
on the market, and a lot of really poor products. And that's what I was saying with the difference between the craft distilling industry and the craft brewing industry was that early on, or especially the craft distilling industry, had a lot of poor products, while the big guys have kind of always had really pretty good products. Besides some big guys, but a lot of there's a lot of distilleries that have always had really fabulous products. And so the reaction of craft distilling has been much more of people just wanting to make things by hand and kind of make things small, you know, a reaction to just the large cultural shift, I think, towards craft in general.
Which I think is nice, getting back to your roots and hands-on and
100%.
Higher quality.
Yeah, I mean, the hope is that every city will have a craft distillery and a craft brewery, and you know,
it's good to have a dream.
People will drink all the time. It'll be fabulous. They thought that back in the 90s, and it still hasn't happened. So, but thankfully, I think being in Sacramento or most places, you're pretty close. You know, you can go to San Francisco or Portland. There's a lot of great places. We were in Brooklyn just a couple years ago, and that New York is just exploding with craft distilling industry. There is amazing. They're producing great, great products. So yeah, it's pretty exciting. And I think now is finally people are starting to kind of get the drift of what's going on. And so those who are producing the products are kind of understanding, okay, we need to be a little more upfront than we were before, because that's what our consumer, you know, wants.
And plus it's, oh, we got busted. I guess we have to say the truth.
Exactly.
That's the reality of it.
Exactly.
Now, one of my grandfathers always had Old Crow, because that was back in, you know, 40s.
Yeah.
30s, 40s, and of course, now Old Crow doesn't have the same appeal that it used to. But some of those old decanters are worth quite a bit of money.
Yeah. My father-in-law just found a bottle of Crown Royal from like 1962 that his father-in-law had but never drank. It was like perfectly encapsulated. So we had been talking about, we're going to have kind of a little get-together on his block with all of his buddies, and we'll kind of document it and see how it compares to the new one.
Fun.
Yeah, so that should be fun. I'm excited. You know, I know that it's a very basic bottling, and so it probably won't be a whole lot different, but it's always interesting because sometimes, especially with those very baseline products, they were actually better at one point, rather than they kind of, as they get larger, they tend to decrease in quality, but we'll see.
Wasn't there somebody in the news recently who, there's like 100 bottles, is it?
Oh yeah.
He drank half of them. It's like 50 bottles he drank of this during Prohibition times. Oh. It was in this house that he was supposed to be helping renovate.
Oh, really?
Or something. Yeah, I mean, just the closet was filled with over 100 bottles
that
had never been opened.
So someone was a collector and he...
No, they'd never been opened. They just, apparently the previous owners...
Oh, and he
had been
found,
part of
he had found, he had kind of...
Well, he saw them all in there and he thought he'd...
Why not?
Take a couple or two and then 52 or something like that and drank them all. And
lucky.
Later claimed he just dusted off a couple. It's like, no, your DNA is on a few of these bottles. Like, nice try.
Lucky guy. I mean,
so it must have tasted pretty good for him to drink over 50 of them.
Yeah, I mean, if it's sealed, no air is getting to it, you can save it for a long time. Once it's opened, and you know, a lot of times how corks are, they're not the best sealers, but I'm surprised. Sometimes you can find stuff and it's just as good as the day it was put in there, so...
It was a magical day for
him.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
He had to pay for it.
Yeah.
Then he got busted. Now, let's talk about in Tennessee, because wasn't legislation passed recently?
Yeah.
Distinguishing the different types?
Yeah, so Tennessee whiskey, which is... So you have two major distilleries. You have George Dickel and Jack Daniels, and they're labeled as Tennessee whiskey. We actually have a George Dickel single barrel in there. And what distinguishes a Tennessee whiskey, and up until now it hasn't been by law, it's just simply been how it's been done, it's been by tradition, is simply Tennessee whiskey is basically bourbon, straight bourbon, and then they do a process of charcoal mellowing. So it's sugar maple charcoal, which after distillation, they will run through the sugar maple charcoal. And that charcoal takes a lot of those congeners out, some of the bad flavors, the harsher flavor notes out of the whiskey in it, and it mellows out the whiskey. It kind of smooths it out. And so what you get, rather than a bourbon, which is generally very much more upfront, you get a more... just kind of easy drinking bourbon, essentially. That's what it is. A lot of people will disagree with me. I mean, there's blogs for miles, you know, debating this one thing, but essentially it's the what's called the Lincoln County process. And once you put it through the Lincoln County process, it's called Tennessee whiskey. Now, and there's only been two distilleries up until just recently, because you have craft distilleries opening up. So what happens when you have a guy that opens up a distillery in Tennessee and he doesn't want to do the Lincoln County process? What then? And he wants to call it Tennessee whiskey. Well, that's a problem, especially for the big guys that are trying to protect what they've been doing for more than, you know, 40, 50, 60 years. That's a real problem. And So legislation was just passed and put into law that to be labeled Tennessee whiskey, that you have to go through the Lincoln County process. I know Jack Daniel's does it before they age their whiskey, and George Dickel does it after they age their whiskey, but you have to do it at some point.
Some point it has to be part of the process.
And a lot of people were pretty angry about it. I myself would say that I think in general it's a pretty good thing. Why? Because I think we want experimentation. I mean, I'm one of the biggest supporters of craft whiskey out there, but I think to have styles is a real good thing, and to say what are those styles and what is it that classifies particular whiskey, because that's the thing with what is a craft distillery, and that's been a big problem, is we don't have a whole lot, we don't really have anything saying that. I mean, there's some organizations trying to say this is what essentially is a craft distillery, but there's not a whole lot of legislation going around to kind of label it what these things are. And I think it's a good thing to have, you know, an understanding, because it creates less confusion, and then from there you can experiment and do different things.
It raises the value of
exactly, exactly, because then it's you can't make Tennessee whiskey anywhere but Tennessee. And that's the thing with Kentucky, you know, or like certain other places with bottled in Kentucky. Bourbon can be made anywhere, but having that thing where it says bottled and produced in Kentucky is a big deal, and it produces a lot of value. I wish every state would have legislation that would say this is, under these guidelines, you can label it California whiskey or Oregon whiskey, because not that you can't go outside of that, but if you
know what to expect.
And you know what to expect, because again, you're gonna be able to invest in, you can't invest outside of that. You have to invest in California if you want to get California whiskey. But a lot of people don't like guidelines. So I do understand that.
Kind of one foot on either side of the continental divide.
Exactly. Exactly.
Years ago, old high school Betty and I went on a road trip, and we went to Jim Beam.
Mm-hmm.
And then Maker's Mark.
Awesome.
Jim Beam, of course, is like the Disneyland of souvenirs.
Yeah.
And Maker's Mark is polar opposite.
Yeah.
It looked like a movie set. There was hardly anybody there. The property looked pristine.
Mm-hmm.
And there was hardly any souvenirs to be had, except for, you know, their product, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, I really enjoyed the mint julep whiskey, because I wasn't expecting it. No way would I ever buy it. But it was just kind of a fun little unexpected treat. But that's the only whiskey that I've ever tasted that had a specific flavor to it like that. They're starting to join vodka now, and they're trying to...
Yeah, yeah. You're seeing some of the guys... Well, actually, everyone's doing it. Ireland, Scotland, U.S. I think... You know, I'm trying to think. There's so many different flavors coming out all the time. I think a lot of, like, Jim Beam does a few different kinds, and everyone's doing a lot of that kind of stuff. And I haven't had many of them, honestly, but, you know, a lot of people don't like that because they think it's tainting it. I think we're coming to, I don't know if we're quite there yet, but we'll get to the point where people will be like, okay, that's okay. It's...
I don't think that the original demographic will ever go away.
No, never, never. It's always there. But again, I'm definitely, if you enjoy it and it's a good product, you know, whether it's a good product or not, you know, is always the question. But if it's made with care, great. You know, that's always the question. But it also raises awareness, and a lot of times it can be a stepping stone. And that's one thing that I, if anything, at this point, whether those things will stay, because most of those, whenever you see a lot of these, like, kind of a lot of these one-off products, they won't stay around unless you get some, a lot of times I don't feel like you see them stay around. But eventually, they will lead other people to be like, okay, what does it taste like without, you know, honey or cherry or whatever? And they will switch over. And so,
my original go-to drink when I became of drinking, legal drinking age,
mm-hmm.
was bourbon and sevens, because bourbon was in the family.
Yeah.
And when you get to drink a certain type over and over again, you acquire a certain taste.
Yeah.
And those people who were whiskey drinkers said, well, it doesn't matter what kind of whiskey you have with that. You won't know the difference because the sugar in the 7-Up.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I disagree. So buy me three drinks and I will tell you which one is the cheapest, which is more expensive. Only because I drink this particular combination frequently. And they're always stunned when I could tell the difference. But having said that, once I was introduced to good whiskey, mm-hmm. high quality, in a shot glass to be sipped and not just tossed mm-hmm. back, once you're introduced to that, you can't go back. I still have Bourbon Sevens, so don't get me wrong.
Sure.
But there's something about a higher quality whiskey, bourbon, whatever the type is, that is a treat.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
What is your go-to treat that is not an unusual budget, but every once in a while you'll buy that $25 shot?
You actually had talked about this in another interview. Redbreast 12-year-old shares a really special place in my heart, and the cask strength is probably my go-to. It's, to me, one of the best whiskeys out there right now. It's not a budget whiskey, but it's not crazy expensive. You know, I rarely buy really expensive whiskeys. I got to try a 30-year-old Glenlivet when I was at the distillery in Scotland, but that's something very rare occasion. But yeah, it's probably Redbreast cask strength, the 12-year. Whenever I can try a cask strength whiskey, that I'll always do that. I think that's, you're going to get the best of whatever you're tasting.
So tell me about your visit to Glenlivet.
My wife and I were moving from Portland, we took a 3-month trip to Europe and spent a good deal of time in Scotland and Ireland. And now that I think about it, is more of a, almost more of a sabbatical or something like that. You know, we lived and breathed whiskey and culture. You know, I mean, it was incredible. We were living for about a month, we were living in a cottage in Speyside, and for free room and board, we worked at a bed and breakfast. And so we just got to work there and live there for free and get, because of the location of this bed and breakfast, it was right by it was just a perfect location for a lot of the distilleries. Speyside is kind of the heart of distilling in Scotland. If not, you could say the heart of distilling in the world, because it's just where everything is. And it's where a lot of the most Balvaney, Glenlivet, Glenfiddich, all those really kind of, your first single malt, it's probably from Speyside. And so we just got to spend a lot of time there, do a lot of kind of soaking up that culture. And Glenlivet was my first single malt, so it was kind of, I don't know if a pilgrimage to go there. They're a really large distillery, but I think this goes back to me saying, like, I don't necessarily think smaller is always better. I think tradition is a very powerful thing, and if you have a very strong tradition, it could be a bad thing, but it can also be a wonderful thing too. And I think Glenlivet has a wonderful tradition of making single malt scotch, and it was wonderful. And they had a lot of really great whiskey to try for a really inexpensive price too, on the tour. So that was definitely a plus. And it's gorgeous around there. Serene, it really is. Like, you see all these pictures of Scotland, and it really is like that. So yeah, it was fun. We were there, then we went up to the Isle of Skye, Talisker Distillery, which is just, Skye is like another world. I always think of the James Bond movie Skyfall. They go up and they film in the Isle of Skye. It's the whole entire place is like that. And you can just tour this distillery and be kind of talking about whiskey and the, you know, the legends and histories is just quite a wonderful thing. One of the cool things one of the best things about Scotland, I think, is if you have a chance to go, is to be able to drive and actually rent a car. We rented a car, and they give us an Audi. I was never expecting that. So, and people drive very fast, and so you just kind of zip up and down these roads, and it was a real treat. Definitely kind of a great learning experience, especially since it had been kind of such a big progression, learning about whiskey and drinking whiskey for so long, to finally actually really see where it's made. I really want to go back to Ireland, because I was able to get to Dublin and Bushmills and whatnot, but I still haven't got to Kentucky and Tennessee yet. Still need to do that.
Well, over in Scotland and Ireland, what did you learn that you remember really made an impact on you?
The biggest was the distilling process. I mean, they really run you through it. I mean, you know, you think they're going to be pretty hidden. I mean, they're not going to tell you about what yeast strains they use and whatnot, but each distillery is quite unique, and they're very fairly open with how it's produced. And there's just a lot of information to be had. And I think you go to Scotland, I knew pretty much about the distillation process, and just because of through blogging and all this kind of stuff, it's kind of my life. But my wife, I think, finally going and seeing that too, she was, you know, knew it just as well as I did, just from going tour after tour. And each one was unique, each one was interesting, because each one was so different and colorful, and there's such a rich history and story behind each distillery. And because of the fact, I think, that you really get to experience I think Scotland is the best thing, where you're talking about terroir, is whiskey of its place. Whiskey being produced in Speyside is going to taste different than whiskey being produced in Oban or the Lowlands or Highlands or peated whiskey in Islay. It's all going to be different because of where it's located. And obviously, not to the degree of wine, but you actually get to see it tastes salty because it's on the sea. There's like a real saltiness in it. And that's what is really exciting. It kind of opens your eyes up. Yeah. Yeah. A lot of the coastal, you'll get these in most coastal malts. They'll have some of that, because
that makes sense.
It penetrates into the fermentation process, into the soil, into aging. You know, these barrels are aging for years. It's going to get there. The oak is not sealed. You know, things get through. So more than anything, it kind of opened my eyes to how much more there is. You're always learning, but it's like there's a much larger universe, I think.
And depth.
Depth, for sure.
So what started you on your journey to all things whiskey?
Well, my father-in-law, I have him to blame. I have kind of two things. I mean, he was always a Glenfiddich man. And when I was dating my wife, he would always, whenever it was generally on holidays, he would offer me whiskey. I, being a novice, couldn't handle it at all. So I'd have to have one-to-one water and whiskey, and it tasted horrible. I just think that much water and whiskey isn't that delightful, but I kept to it and kind of pushed through, and eventually I could drink it with less and less water. But where I kind of started the journey was my wife and I being up in Portland. You just can't get away from Portland. Is one of those places, you know, they have good food, good beer, good whiskey. You know, everyone knows it's kind of one of the hearts of brewing, and it's a big foodie town, but very few people know it's got more craft distilleries than any city in the world. And so wherever you go, it's just kind of everywhere. And as we were up there, just as kind of whiskey was kind of, the whole culture was kind of changing. And so that's kind of where I started to get into it a little more. And I remember I kept going back to Redbreast 12, and that was the first one that kind of I had, and I was like, wow, like there's something more here than I thought there was. Because I had been a beer drinker, but I hadn't really been that big into whiskey until I had Redbreast 12, which is kind of funny, that being Irish whiskey, you know, not even, Irish whiskey wasn't even that popular yet compared to even what it is now. And so for me, it was, I really just want to kind of start finding out more about this. And so I started a blog called The Bourbon Intelligencer, where I would just review whiskeys. And from there, it just kind of kept going.
What stories have you heard? Being a blogger, you probably get a lot of feedback.
Yeah, it's been kind of an interesting journey. I think it, more than anything, it's been the connections that I've made. I've just, now that I have an actual website going, a lot of the people that started following me at the very beginning, who were just kind of getting into whiskey, and I started a Tumblr, which was a kind of a separate blog that I had used to kind of answer a lot of questions for people. And one of the guys that's writing for me and doing reviews now on my website was one of those original guys. Gosh, now it's probably, I want to say 4 years back, he was asking me questions when he was just getting right into it. Now he's writing for me. All these connections that I made, I have about 4 writers now that are just starting to kind of get online on the site, and I've met them all through beginning this blog. So for me, that's the coolest story that I've really had. And just seeing a lot of people that are just really interested in it. Really, a lot of the discussions, like here, like craft distilling has been such a big thing. And so talking a lot about that, because that's kind of the real, I think, big issue. And especially for a lot of young people, are just so into, everyone's into craft, you know, nowadays. And so we're really kind of moot, like everyone's just so into what's going on. And so there's just been a lot of, through myself, through just trying to figure out, okay, like, I'm getting all these questions about all this stuff. I need to start learning about it. And so that was me just going and reading and doing a lot of research from there.
Well, what's next on your table?
So what's next for me is I have four writers lined up. I'm going to be launching, my biggest thing is I'm going to be launching kind of a 2.0 version of the website. That should be going online around about a month or so. And then I'm going to start moving forward and doing some more interviews and tastings and stuff like that. The whole site's just kind of expanding right now, and it's really about just kind of getting more content. But that's the biggest thing, is the website's just growing tremendously, and so just keep pushing that and kind of the whole whiskey lifestyle and all my writers kind of putting a lot of content. That's been a great thing, because everyone's getting really excited about everything that's kind of going on. So
now for the newbies.
Yeah.
Could you explain the different whiskey categories so they aren't too confused?
Yeah. What you have, basically, I mean, there's a lot of ways you can go about it, but mainly it's, you can say you have kind of American whiskey, and that kind of covers bourbon and Tennessee whiskey and rye whiskey. Rye, a lot of times when people say rye, they really mean Canadian whiskey, which is a blended rye whiskey, which is rye and blend of rye, straight white rye whiskey, and a grain alcohol. But for bourbon, it's generally going to be 51% corn with rye and malted barley in the mash bill. Rye is going to be 51% rye with corn and barley in the mash bill. And then you also have corn whiskey, which is going to be a really large percent of corn. That's kind of for American whiskey. Then you have Irish whiskey and Scotch whiskey are fairly similar in terms of malted barley is the big thing they use. The difference is Scotland uses 100% malted barley and doubled it, twice distilled. So they distill twice everything they do. Ireland does something different where they use partially unmalted barley and malted barley, and they distill it three times. And that's why you get a much kind of lighter, easier drinking spirit. And then you have Scotland. You can have a lot of different variations. Peated whiskeys, which is when you malt the barley, you're using peat. So you're essentially, after you've let that barley germinate, because malting barley, right, you're trying to trick the barley into germinating, and then you dry it out to provide access for the yeast, that sugar access, so the yeast can get those sugars. What you do with that, when you're malting that barley and drying it, you're using peat, and so it imparts that peat flavor into it, and so you get this very like smoky, dense tasting spirit, and that's going to be the Islay whiskeys. And then you also have Japanese whiskey, which is basically single malt Scotch whiskey, or very similar, because they took all the practices essentially from Scotland. The interesting thing now is that you have craft whiskey, which is kind of, there's Balcones, which is using blue corn. I know some interesting things. I think you're going to see a lot of interesting grains being used with a lot of the micro guys pretty soon.
Yeah, blue corn sounds good.
Yeah, they're one of the legit guys. I want to say they're in Texas. And yeah, I think you're going to see people are just going to try everything and anything under the sun. That's what's going to be the exciting thing for the craft distilling, but it's just on the brink where we haven't really seen that yet. So I think that pretty much covers it. Obviously, there's a lot of details underneath that, but
for the general topics.
Yeah.
Well, cheers.
Cheers. Yeah.
The Life of a Whiskey Drinker.com is a place for men and women to explore whiskey and its surrounding culture. Check it out. In my continuing celebration of national parks, I'm heading over to Marsh Billings Rockefeller in Woodstock, Vermont. So, who were Marsh Billings and Rockefeller? George Perkins Marsh championed the creation of a U.S. Army Camel Corps, was the author of the 1864 Man and Nature, and one of the first proponents of environmental issues. Frederick Billings was a lawyer and railroad entrepreneur who not only bought the property from the Marsh family, but was deeply influenced by Marsh's environmental work and established a progressive dairy farm and professionally managed forest on the property. The Rockefeller in this case was his granddaughter Mary, who married Lawrence Spelman Rockefeller. She and Lawrence sustained those practices in foresting and farming during the latter half of the 20th century. The park, created in 1992 as a gift from Mary and Lawrence, includes the property's residence and the 550-acre forest. Tucked into the hills of the park's Mount Tom Forest is a 14-acre pond named the Pogue and has a lovely rumor of being bottomless. No swimming, fishing, or even wading is allowed in the Pogue. 14 miles of carriage roads donated by John D. Rockefeller Jr. in the early 20th century traverse the park. The National Park Service's book, New Birth of Freedom, was inspired by a walking tour developed by rangers at Marsh Billings Rockefeller National Park. It tells the story of the warriors in Vermont through the stories of still existing buildings and the former inhabitants of a town that had a sizable free African-American population at the time. Frederick Law Olmsted Sr. wrote to Marsh in 1857, asking his advice on promoting free soil settlement in Texas to challenge the westward expansion of slavery. Strongly anti-slavery, both men would also champion land stewardship and public access to places like Yosemite Valley. 11 African-American veterans of the 54th Massachusetts are buried adjacent to the park. Lawrence Rockefeller eloquently wrote, "The true importance of Marsh Billings and those who follow in their footsteps goes beyond simple stewardship. Their work transcends maintenance. It involves new thought and new action to enhance and enrich the past. We cannot rest on the achievements of the past. Rather, each generation must not only be stewards, but activists, innovators, and enrichers." Grandparents' Day is coming up. Mine have all passed, but I loved Grammy, Grampy, Grandpa Bo, and Grandma Jerry very much, and I miss them. Do something different. Wish upon the first star you see tonight.